Yes.
You've gone away, but wait, here, now you're back. Okay.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, so did you see my topics? Are you okay with everything I wanted to talk about?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So what do you want to tell me about the series?
The show I just directed for Apple is a 6-part musical. I know nothing about musicals. It's called Schmigadoon. It's kind of vaguely based on Brigadoon.
Right.
And it's all about all those MGM musicals from the 30s, 40s, 50s, you know, Singing in the Rain and all that.
Wow.
So it looks like we shot it, you know, we hope it will look like we shot it on Technicolor. We shot it all on stage. We were going to have painted backings, but the stages weren't quite big enough, and it would have taken too long to change, you know, the painted backings. You know, let's say we boomed down and we would want to change to the horizon. We'd have to get grips to lower the painted backing. So we ended up shooting it mainly on blue screen, except for one stage. We actually had a painted backing, which looks fantastic, but we shot it on blue screen, but are making the backgrounds look like they're painted backings.
Okay.
So it's a 6-part series. Each are a half hour long. There's about 16 musical numbers, and it stars Keegan-Michael Key and Cecily Strong. They're a couple that take this hike to get their relationship back together again. And they end up in this mystical town called Schmigadoon and can't get out until they can only leave with their true love. And they keep not being able to get out, so they wonder if they are each other's true love. I won't tell you how it ends, but of course, Cecily's character loves musicals, and Keegan's character hates musicals. So he's just in a lot of pain. And then we also, in addition to Cecily and Keegan, we have Kristen Chenoweth, we have Alan Cumming, we've got Fred Armisen, we've got all these great, Jane Krakowski and other great cast members who all can sing and dance. And I, who knew nothing about singing or dancing, agreed to do this musical. So that's kind of amusing. We had Bo Welch, the great production designer who I've worked with often,
right,
as a production designer. And the scripts were written and the songs and lyrics were written by a guy named Cinco Paul. Cinco
right.
Paul was the writer on all the first three Despicable Me's, The Secret Life of Pets. So this is his first live action show, and he was the showrunner and executive producer along with me. And it's a lot of fun.
So two questions. One is, what kind of prep did you do for this? As far as, did you go back and look at the films? Did you do like a lot of historical research? Did you just basically knew how you wanted to approach it?
I'll tell you the truth. I so dislike musicals that it was really painful for me to do any research. I knew Singing in the Rain. Although for me, my favorite stuff in Singing in the Rain is Donald O'Connor stuff.
Yeah.
Make 'em Laugh is one of my favorite moments. I did watch Brigadoon and somehow managed to get through that. But I did very little research because I just didn't like musicals very much. And it would always joke with Cinco on the set whenever we would do a rehearsal of a song, I'd go, do we need this song? So I did very little prep in terms of research. I did a lot of prep in terms of, you know, designing the shots, working with Bo to design the town, that kind of stuff. Again, we shot entirely on stage, except for, I think we were out for one day, maybe 2 days out of 43 days, all shot in Vancouver, which is where I like to work, great crews. And the interesting thing is the COVID of it all, which I assumed would be a total nightmare and would slow us down tremendously, because there were different zones. For instance, when the actors were on the set, only people that had been tested 3 times a week, which put them in the red zone, were allowed to be on the set. So we would do a rehearsal with a witness cam, and people in the yellow zone or other colored zones would watch in another room. including grips, electricians, camera assistants. And then we would have the actors leave, and then the stand-ins who had been watching on the witness cam would come in, and the rest of the crew would come in. We would light, we'd be ready, and then those people would have to leave, and only the red team could stay on set, which was very few people. So I assumed that would slow us down, because anytime a DP wanted to make a change or, you know, put a double net in this light or something, it would be a disaster, but it really wasn't. And in fact, we finished one day ahead of schedule. It was 43 days. Everyone in the red zone, whenever we were near the actors, had to wear, in addition to a mask, which we all wore 12 and a half hours a day, you also had to wear either goggles or a face shield. Mm-hmm. And it was hard for the DP because the actors would rehearse wearing their face shields. And, you know, so you'd see reflections and you couldn't tell. Yeah, but it worked out. And we finished a day early instead of a day over. I thought we'd be a week over. So that was all easy breezy, except at the end of 12 and a half hours, you felt really happy to be home without wearing a mask.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
And incident free, right?
Incident free. We had no incidents in those 43 days. Rose Lem, who is the one of the producers and is the local Vancouver, my relationship to the crew is through Rose. She felt one of the reasons we were very lucky is because we were working 6 day weeks. We were working 6 day weeks because Cecily Strong had an out date. She had to get back to New York to do some SNL stuff. So because we were working 6 day weeks, the crew had no time to go out and socialize.
Yeah.
On the seventh day, they were either doing the laundry or hanging out with their kids or whatever. So there was very little interaction that the crew had except being with us. So I think 6 day weeks was very helpful for us on this show, actually.
Yeah, weren't you one of the first productions to get started during the pandemic?
Yeah, you know, I insisted that I would only do the show if we shot it in Vancouver.
Yeah.
I felt that Vancouver was safe, and that New York and LA at the time, you know, wasn't safe. And, you know, this is months ago. We finished shooting December 3rd. We started to shoot in October, and we were in prep for a couple of months before that. So Vancouver ended up being a really good location for us because it was, they had their act together, and we were one of the few shows that were able to shoot, actually.
Yeah.
If we had decided on New York or LA, we would still be in pre-production, or we would have been shut down.
Yeah.
In addition, the crew's just really good up here. We had great dancers. We had a great core of 19 or 23 dancers that were all so good. They all worked as locals, but some of them lived in Vancouver, some Toronto. They all work in New York on Broadway shows or in LA, but they're all Canadians or dual citizens. And our dancers and singers were as good as anything we would have gotten in New York or LA. And in fact, probably would have had a lot of the same people.
Great. All right. There's no logic to my next couple of questions. But first off, is this similar to how you approached Unfortunate Events? Because you did almost all the shooting for that on the soundstage in Vancouver as well, right?
When I met Netflix to see if they would hire me to be the director of a series of Unfortunate Events, the very first meeting I had with them is, here's a plan. I want to shoot it entirely in Vancouver on stage and have Lemony Snicket be an on-screen narrator who walks in and out of scenes. And everything that you see in a series of Unfortunate Events, I talked about in my sort of interview session with Netflix. So it's exactly the same way we worked. It was all on stage. I think we, in the 3 years of a series of Unfortunate Events, there was only one episode, which Bo directed, called Miserable Mill, where we left stage. And that was because we just didn't have enough time, because as you know, every two episodes, which was a different book, we had totally different venues. Mm-hmm. So we were always tearing down sets as soon as we finished them and building new sets while we were still shooting on the same stage. You know, crews were working at night, and you would see part of a stage being next episode and part of the stage being the episode we are presently shooting. And it's funny because Bo's episode, and Bo's a production designer and did an amazing job, Miserable Mill, we actually had to leave and find a warehouse and create a mill. And it's the only episode Bo and I always laugh about it that looks out of place, that doesn't look in the same world. And it's because we actually went outside to a real world. And it looks somehow fake and not in the world we created, which is ironic. But yes, similar idea. The Vancouver is great if you are shooting on stage. If you're shooting outside, it's problematic because in the winter it rains every day or it gets dark very early. And in the summer, if you have night exteriors, it gets dark at 10 p.m. and light at 4 a.m. So, so the best way to shoot in Vancouver, my feeling is shoot entirely on stage because the crews are great, the stages are great, the lifestyle of Vancouver is great. It's just the exterior is iffy and problematic. You never know what you're going to get from day to day.
Right, right. This could be completely off base, but is there any anticipation of what you did with this in Pushing Daisies? Because I know you did like at least one musical number in there, and it sort of had that stylized look to it. Am I just guessing here?
You know, everything I do feels like it's the same show, whether it's Adam's Family, Men in Black, Pushing Daisies, A Series of Unfortunate Events, the stuff I did as a cinematographer, whether it was Throw Mama from the Train or Raising Arizona or Miller's Crossing, or I always like to find a way to stylize visually a show. And I also feel, and unlike most directors, I feel that the camera can be a character in the show. Mm-hmm. And I think that the character is more, that the camera can be a character in the show, and that a camera is more than a recording device. It's a storytelling device. And there's a reason why from movie to movie or TV show to TV show, I use certain lenses. It's not just arbitrary why I would have a 21 millimeter on or why I would have a 50 millimeter on. It's part of the storytelling process. So Pushing Daisies in some ways was the first thing that was both fantasy and was so stylized. Although, you know, that's only because I don't think that Men in Black feels like a fantasy show so much as a reality-based movie. But yes, Pushing Daisies is a lot like what we did both in terms of A Series of Unfortunate Events and now Schmigadoon. There's a certain stylized world creation that they all have in common.
Okay. Yeah, I got the question I'll get to when I talk to you about Get Shorty in a minute. But were you able to use the cameras you wanted to this time? Because I know in Unfortunate Events, Netflix insisted that you shoot with 4K. And I think you wanted to use like Arri cameras that were like 3.8 or something like that.
3.7. No, same issue with Apple. This is for Apple. They insist on 4K. It's one of the things that drives me crazy. 4K, as it relates to Apple, Netflix, is a marketing tool, not an aesthetic tool. Mm-hmm. The best looking video cameras up till now are the Arris, is Arriflex's Alexa. And it's 3.7K, so it's not quite 4K. So they don't let you use it, which is unfortunate because the Alexa feels the most like film. It has a softer image. It's not as electronic. So what does a cameraman do when forced into a situation where they can't use Arri and they have to use other cameras? They destroy the image enough to make it look like film.
Yeah.
So they put glitter filters or glamour filters or fog filters in front of the lens, in the case of our cinematographers. In the case of some other cinematographers, they go out and they find 50-year-old cooks that have no anti-reflective coatings so that the lenses are crappy and not as sharp. Mm-hmm. So what they're trying to do is take the 4K image and turn it into a crappier image, because 4K is not the friend of actors, where you can see every pore and every little bit of wig line or uneven makeup. So what we're doing is we're taking the 4K, which is a marketing tool, and seeing what we can do to destroy that image enough so it doesn't look like 4K.
Yeah.
While if they let us use the Alexa, which is 3.7K or 3.8K, we wouldn't put all the crap in front of the lenses to make the image look less good, because the nature of the Alexa is a much softer filmic image. So it's as dumb as HDR is. Listen, I love HDR when I shoot still photographs, because what it does is it lets you shoot multiple exposures. So you can use the shadow, the overexposed shadow area of one exposure and the underexposed highlights of another exposure. So you can actually shoot, let's say, in the woods and not either have to expose for the shadows or the highlights, right. You know? There are reasons why HDR can be good. But what HDR also does, and it ruined the second and third season for me and Bo and the cinematographer, where we were forced to finish in HDR, because again, it's a marketing tool. It's not an aesthetic tool necessarily. What HDR also does is it says, oh, let me help Barry. Look at those. I'm gonna expand the contrast. So in the second and third seasons, we were trying to have everything be incredibly muted and have a very narrow palette.
Right.
And HDR says, oh, I can help those guys out. Poor guys. They had a limited palette and everything so muted and not contrasty. I can fix that. And we were constantly fighting and unsuccessfully to get it back the way it originally looked in SD or 4K, but not HDR.
Right.
So it started with CineFlow. That tried to ruin movies. Now 4K is trying to ruin movies. Now HDR is trying to ruin movies. And the truth is all these technologies are marketing technologies. They're designed by engineers who think they have a better way to make it look. But they're not creative people, they're engineers.
Yeah.
And those three things, CineFlow, 4K, and HDR, are constant battles that we're fighting to get things to look more like film and less like electronic medium.
I won't even ask you about 8K then.
I'll tell you the truth. 8K is perfect for Canadians because you can finally see a hockey puck. So I think 8K in sports is great. You know, I want to see that hockey puck and not actually wait for the blue light to come on and the siren to go on to know that there's been a goal. So they're 8K for sports, I look forward to it. But as a tool, if I was a member of SAG, I would see if I could get my leadership to not allow movies to be shot or TV shows to be shot in 8K, because I don't want you to see every pore in my skin, every wig line, every age line.
Yeah. Okay.
And all we're going to do is we'll keep having to find crappier lenses to use for 8K or put more crap. In fact, you know, both Apple and Netflix allow a certain amount of cropping on an image, you know, if there's a boom in the shot or if there's part of someone's nose and you want to get rid of it in post, you can crop up to 20%, which means there goes your 4K.
Yeah.
So it's all about marketing and not about what's best for the show.
Okay. One last question about this and I wanted to move on. Anything about working with Apple and Netflix at this point, or the whole idea of working outside the traditional studio system and the way that streaming services have sort of taken over that role?
There are many advantages to shooting for a streaming service than for shooting for commercial broadcast television. A lot of it has to do with the fact that, A, you can tell a story over multiple episodes, which you can't do on a feature, but also on a commercial network like ABC or CBS, there's a very specific structure to the acts, because you have to have act break for commercials. Mm-hmm. The first act can only be, I'm making this up, between 7 and 9 minutes. You have to have four acts. No act can be longer than X amount of minutes. The fourth act can't be longer than this. So you end up writing for this very technical need on commercial television. While on streaming television, it's very different. You know, on a series of unfortunate events, we had shows that went from an hour to under 40 minutes. There was no rules in terms of how long a show needed to be. If a show needed to be 47 minutes and 36 seconds, that's how long the show was, mm-hmm. which is fantastic that you're not stuck with these half hour or hour shows. On the show I just did, Schmigadoon, there are 6 half-hour shows, but some of them are, one is 32 minutes, one is 30 minutes, two are 27 minutes, one is 25 minutes. So again, it's a very liberating way to work.
Right.
And the studios are different too. You know, they can take chances. It's why the writing has gotten so good on streaming television. There are two reasons why streaming television, I think, exploded. One is that because no executive will be fired at Netflix if one of their shows doesn't do well, mm-hmm. because of putting out, you know, 20 a week or whatever it is. So the stock doesn't go down if they release season 3 of Lost in Space and it isn't good. I'm making this up. Mm-hmm. While at a movie studio, the traditional movie studio, Sony was ended up putting out like 12 movies a year. That's one a month. That means that any one movie represents a huge amount of their revenue stream. So if a single movie doesn't do well or gets terrible reviews, stockholders are talking about, should we fire the head of the studio? Therefore, movie studios stop taking chances.
Yeah.
It's why they only want to make IPs, sequels, and things that are pre-marketed, because mm-hmm. also the cost of marketing movies is so expensive. I once had a movie I wanted to do for $20 million, and they said, it's going to cost us $40 million to market and distribute it. We'd rather spend $60 million than $20 million. Yeah. Weird, but true.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's really changed and allowed us streaming to really expand exponentially, and I think it started with Breaking Bad, is because of plasma TVs, LCDs, LEDs, OLEDs, because of these much bigger screens that are 16:9 aspect ratio, you no longer had to frame for a 4:3 television image, and you suddenly could have wide shots. Television used to be, when I started, a totally close-up medium, because televisions were 19 inches, and they were square, and that's sort of perfect for a head, but not good for wide vistas. But with the advent of, and that's one of the good things about technology, I've been saying how bad CineMotion is and HDR and 4K, but what's great is these widescreen televisions. That's really changed the way we frame and think, and it's why now on any streaming network, whether there's no way you can tell if it's a movie or a streamer. They look equally as good. The lighting is so much better. The framing is so much better than it's ever been.
Okay. I want to segue briefly to talk about your screening room, because now that you're in Vancouver, over the years, how many different screening rooms have you had?
In my life, I've had 3 really good screening rooms. The best screening room was in the house we built in Amagansett, New York, in the Hamptons. All 3 were below ground. And that what's interesting is not everywhere in the United States or Canada is our basements considered part of a house, you know? I mean, there are very few basements in California. But our screening room in the Hamptons was the best ever. The sound was designed by the guy who did the DGA screening room. Mm-hmm. There was not a 90-degree wall in there. There were semicircle walls. It was extraordinary. In fact, Spielberg said it was the best-sounding screening room he had been in on the East Coast. So that was a great screening room. In fact, that one, we had a double system 35-millimeter projection, you know, which meant we had Magnatech recorders in the back, We had a third window, so if we wanted to, I could have even mixed there. There was a third window in the screening room for a third projector that would have a shutterless projector, which you need for mixing. It was fantastic. And I think the Sony, always have used Sony projectors. That one was a CRT three lens. I think it was like the 1280 or something. I don't know, but it was a three lens CRT projector. Beautiful projector. The next one I had was also in the Hamptons after we sold that house. And that was another, that one, all the screening rooms we had, and the third one was in Telluride, have all been underground, usually seated between 12 and 16 people, mainly chairs and couches, not movie chairs with, you know, cup holders or anything like that.
Right.
And this one in Pemberton, British Columbia, will be the first one that's above ground, where our house is on a floodplain. So if you dig down more than about a foot, you get water. So the space I think I'm going to use not only is sort of above ground on the second floor, but also has some windows. So it's going to be a very different experience. I think it's going to be, we have another den, which on three sides has a continuous couch, which has about a 75-inch sharp. That's probably 4 or 5 years old. That isn't bad. But, you know, that's the other thing that's changed about screening rooms for me. You know, I'm a member of the Academy and the DGA. This is going to be the last year that they send out screeners on Blu-ray or DVD. Mm-hmm. It's all going onto an app that you download from Apple TV that has all the Academy movies on it. And we're now watching our Academy screeners electronically via Apple TV and this app, which of course saves the studios millions of dollars in shipping. You know, I used to get 150 UPS and FedEx deliveries during this time of year.
Yeah.
And now I'm getting a dozen or two. And next year will be zero.
Okay. One more question about the screening room that I'm on the move on. Is there anything you're looking to do with this one that you haven't had a chance to do before with a space like this? So anything that's happened with the technology or whatever that you're looking to have some fun with?
It's funny because, you know, I used to be a cinematographer. Now I'm a director. So you would think that what's most important to me is visual. But I think I love sound and I love subwoofers, as we've talked about.
Yeah.
And I think what I'm looking forward to in this one is I've never had any sort of Atmos system. I've always had 5.1 surround or Dolby, but right. I haven't explored a more immersive sound. I've always had a lot of subwoofers. My screening room in Telluride had more, six times more subwoofers than the Ziegfeld Theater in Manhattan had. we were always afraid we were going to knock down the house whenever we played anything that Michael Bay produced. But I think if, you know, this, there are certain challenges to this room. It's fairly square. It's got a high ceiling. Mm-hmm. It's got hard walls. We'll probably put up some draperies or stuff. But I'm curious what can be done electronically to soften the room, do away with a lot of the sort of hard surfaces, and give us a good sound design.
Be a good chance for you to play with digital room correction then. There's some beautiful systems out there. Yeah. Let's talk about Get Shorty for a second, if you don't mind. So this is the 25th anniversary, right? And I just reviewed it because Clydescape got the MGM UA catalog for the first time. And the whole time, I just kept wishing it was in 4K. Yeah, I wish they'd upgraded it so it looked closer to what you originally shot the film at. One, any thoughts on the film on the 25th anniversary? And second, do you get involved with the process when somebody comes and does a UHD upgrade to one of your films?
Yeah, I try to. In fact, I didn't know that this was the 25th anniversary of Get Shorty until recently, and I wish that I had paid attention to that because I would have asked MGM if they could do a 4K release. I would have done a special edition, you know, found storyboards or that kind of stuff and done another commentary. You know, the timing, I'm trying to remember, I don't even think the color timing of Get Shorty had a DI. I think it was still, you know, a film
right.
color timing, because this would have been 25 years ago. I don't think there were DIs back then. So I would have loved to have had a chance to go in and retime it and make it as good as possible. It's still my favorite movie that I've ever directed. I'm really proud of it. So it would have been fun. And Criterion called me up a couple weeks ago because they're going to do a new release of Miller's Crossing. Mm-hmm. And I told them they should also look into doing a new release of both Addams Families and in 4K, and also Get Shorty, that I would love to be involved in helping them. And there's a really great dance number in Addams Family that was cut in half. And I wish we could restore the entire dance number called the Mamushka that Raul Julia and Chris Lloyd do together. But I would love for there to be a 4K release of Get Shorty.
Yeah, just because I was reviewing it, I was really paying attention to it this time, and it's a very subtle. The look of the film is very subtle, so that every time you do a camera move or whatever, it really has a nice impact to it.
Yeah, there are some shots in there I really, really like. It's not world creation, you know, like the way Men in Black is, or yeah. Pushing Daisies, or some of the other things we talked about, but it still has a lot of style. There's a really cool shot of an airplane that's flying upside down, and we
yeah.
tilt with it, and it reveals Delroy Lindo for the first time, reading Variety.
Another thing that really struck me is the casting in that film, all the way down to the smallest role. There are no flaws. Everybody's strong in there, and you like somehow managed to flesh out every little part in that film.
The one mistake I made was casting myself as the bellman outside the Century Plaza Hotel when Chili Palma pulls up and hands me a tip, and I'm wearing like some stupid hat and costume, which the doorman wore back then at the Century Plaza Hotel. I was terrible. And my only line was, thank you, sir, but I blew it. I love the casting. In fact, one very small role, when Gene Hackman gets his neck broken, the doctor who says, okay, who wants to take a crack at Mr. Zim's neck or something like right. that, is played by Patrick Breen, who went on to be in almost every movie I've directed. Breen was in A Series of Unfortunate Events all three seasons. He was one of the members of the VFD. He meets his demise in a large chili vat in the last season, in the penultimate episode. But we were very lucky. We had a great cast. Farina is fantastic in the part as Ray Bones. Hackman is great. Danny yeah. DeVito is great. Travolta and Rene Russo were fantastic, and I love that process. Is that you or me? I'm hearing.
That's you.
Well, sorry. Suddenly, Siri wanted to talk. It was telling me about the penultimate episode.
But anyways, it may be, I said this in the review, to me it may be the ultimate Hollywood satire, just because you don't have a big axe to grind, but it's like a series of grace notes that gets it absolutely right.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I always felt that the movie was less about Hollywood and more about self-confidence. In a way, self-confidence meets Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Because what I loved is that everyone ends up wanting to be like John Travolta's character, Chili Palma. They all want to be like him because he's self-confident. In fact, you know, I said to Scott Frank, who wrote the screenplay, the novel was written by Elmore Leonard, but it's amazing how much Scott added. Scott has gone on to direct, you know, Queen's Gambit and other things. But
yeah,
I said to Scott, I want to give Travolta a really crappy something that looks like really stupid and crappy, but by the end of the movie, everyone is either wearing that thing or doing that thing. And then Scott and I came up with the idea of giving him a really bad rental car. And there's that scene where he drives out in the pouring rain, drives out to the rental car parking lot, and the only car that's available is an Oldsmobile Silhouette, which is a minivan that had an electric door on one side. And he hates this car. But by the end of the show, everyone is driving Penny Marshall, Gene Hackman, they're all driving Oldsmobile silhouettes, and it was hard to find as many as we needed for the last shot in the movie, which is this big pullback, and you can see everyone getting into their Oldsmobile silhouettes. So for me, the movie was about self-confidence and about how no one in Hollywood has any confidence. So if someone comes in with confidence, they will rule Hollywood. They will become big time producers. And that's what happens with Chili Palmer. It's just because he's confident, everyone seeks him out.
Right.
And trusts him. Yeah.
Right. I hope it happens. I hope they get to do the upgrade soon. I wanted to ask you real quick about the Oscars, because you may know something I don't. I don't see how they can legitimately do it this year. You know, given theaters closed, that the studios have been sitting on films, that there haven't been any release windows, and almost everything interesting has happened on streaming. How do you do the Oscars?
Well, I don't know how you do them, but they're doing them. And it's still movies that have been released theatrically for a week. But you look at that list, you know, I have all the streamers that have been downloaded electronically to this app. And my wife go into our den every night to look at a movie. And we look at all the Oscar available movies, and we end up instead watching Rachel Maddow and Brian Williams because there's so little that was released this year.
It's almost like, you know, strike year in baseball. You have to put an asterisk next to everything this year.
Right. Right.
You know, how can it be legitimate? It's just, I mean, it could end up being a great film that wins Best Picture, but it's just, it wasn't an open field, you know?
No, it wasn't. But as you say, you know, the rules change. Like, I don't understand how you can have the whole concept of the designated hitter in baseball is another example of something I don't get, because part of the joy of, and also the fact that American League and National League have different rules about the designated hitter. But for me, one of the joys of baseball was, does the manager take out the pitcher who's pitching a no-hitter into the seventh, but you're down by one run and you have two guys on base? You bring out your pitcher and put in a pinch hitter, or do you leave your pitcher in there? Well, if you've got the designated hitter rule, that takes out part of the joyful strategy of baseball.
Yeah.
So in the same way, I don't know, there'll be a lot of asterisks this year, because a lot of movies, they're just holding back and waiting for the, you know, theaters to open again. But I think the concept of movie theaters is going to become less and less of a reality. I think studios are going to make fewer and fewer movies. Here's the other thing. The economics for studios is very different, because if you're releasing movies, you've got these actors, these big time actors are getting, you know, a percentage of gross, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If they then release a movie for 30 days and it makes $15 million instead of $400 million, and then it goes to HBO Max, you don't have to pay any of those residuals. You're paying residuals on $15 million, not half a billion, to the actors, to the DGA. So, and you're selling it to yourself. Like, Warner Brothers is selling these movies, big time movies, to themselves. So it's changing the finances of how directors get paid, actors get paid. In addition, when a movie goes into a movie theater, the studio already gives 50% to the distributor, to the a theater owner. So it may be that they realize that there's no upside to movie theater releases anymore, except for a few big time movies.
Yeah, well, you know, because 75-inch screens and bigger are becoming the norm now. And if you've got screens that are that big with 4K delivery, what's the advantage of going to a theater?
The only advantage is comedies.
Yeah.
Because there's a joy of hearing other people laughing. But on the other hand, there's the cost of the babysitter, the cost of the tickets, the cost of parking, the cost of eating out, the cost of, probably most theaters don't have as good a sound system or as good a projection system as you now get at home. We've discussed that for years, you know. In East Hampton, they would take the subwoofers out because people watching the romantic comedy next to the people watching the Michael Bay movie were complaining because of the subs. in the theater next door because they didn't do a good job isolating. Mm-hmm. So the sound was never as good as you could get as at home. So I think that the concept of movie theaters is really going to change. There'll be way fewer.
Okay, last question about the Oscars, really quickly though. Given what's going on with theatrical releases and everything, should they just allow streaming content in if it's well produced and there's absolutely nothing to distinguish it other than the fact that it didn't get into a theater? Should they be considered?
Not yet.
Okay.
Maybe in 4 years from now. But at the moment, I think that you need to know what a movie is versus otherwise, is anything that's 90 minutes long a movie, or is it an Emmy nomination, or is it an Oscar nomination? What's if you only have one episode or something, is that called a movie? But and I think that it's still too complicated a situation.
Agreed. Okay. If you don't mind, I was going to ask you, how do you feel about people shooting professionally on their phones now? You know, with the iPhone 12 Pro and all this other stuff coming out. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
You know what? Shooting movies on iPhones, it's an interesting technique. Every time I see like a behind the scenes shot of someone shooting a movie on an iPhone, the iPhone is in a rig. It's stabilized. It looks so big that you might as well just be using a real camera that has many more layers of color control and gamma. You know, it's not just about resolution. It's also about color space and all these other things. And that's why you use professional movie cameras and not iPhones. Yeah. It's not just about, you know, can it shoot 4K? Great, let's use it. And then I use an iPhone a lot to design shots. I line up camera positions using my iPhone and an app called CadReg that you can say 21 millimeter, what format, what mm-hmm. lens, you know, not only 21 millimeter, but a Cook 21 millimeter, which is different than a Master Prime 21 millimeter. You line up the shot, you hold it. The crew can look exactly where you're holding it. They measure the height, they measure the distance, the camera goes right there. So I do use it as a tool, but I don't use it to shoot on. I will admit, you can move through space really in a very cool way with it. But I don't know, some of these rigs look so big, you might as well shoot it with a real camera with a real proper lens.
Right. Okay, just curious about that. Very, very last question. A friend asked me to ask you this. He said that you were down to do a film about James Randi. Is that a thing?
I saw a documentary in Telluride at the Mountain Film Festival that was about James Randi. That was really good. And there were these other characters in the show that were interesting to me, other characters in this documentary that involved paranormal stuff. And I'm trying to remember.
Is this one like with Uri Geller and stuff like that?
Well, yeah, Geller was in the movie because Randi made it his business to debunk his stuff. But these were secondary characters in the documentary. And I talked to the two producers about doing a fictional story about these kids that were being recruited to do paranormal stuff, but they were really magicians. So they were pretending to have paranormal powers, being able to bend spoons and this and that, but they just knew how to sort of screw with the system. Mm-hmm. And it was an interesting idea, but I'm still involved in it, but we haven't done much over the last several years to do anything with it.
Okay. Now, he was intensely curious about that, so I said I'd ask.
Yeah, it's not about Rand. It wouldn't be about Randi. It would be about these other characters that were in the show.
Okay. Anything else we should talk about? Anything, any holes we should plug in what I brought up?
No, I think it's really, what I'm interested in is how technology and art sort of work and how technology right now is sort of harming art in terms of, as we discussed, CineMotion, HDR, and 4K. Mm-hmm. And just because you can do something technologically doesn't mean you should. Just like, don't start shooting with 8K. I'll tell you what's good about an 8K camera. What's good about an 8K camera is if you can shoot everything with an 8K camera, but you're only going to release it in 4K, it lets you totally reframe, crop.
Yeah.
So because you've got all these pixels, it lets you, especially let's say if you're shooting animals or babies and you couldn't control where they were going to go, and you could shoot everything with one lens too wide, knowing that you were going to crop it back to a 4K image.
Right.
So that would be kind of interesting as a tool. But to just release stuff on 8K, unless it's sports, it sounds like a horrible idea.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. We'll see what the next couple of years bring. That's everything I had. And that was actually a lot. I appreciate your time and your patience.
Oh, please. So thanks so much. Always a pleasure. And do this whenever you need to.
Okay, great. Do you have an air date yet for the series, by the way?
No, I think it will be... I think you're talking about... They want it out for Emmy consideration, but I think it's probably June is my guess. But don't quote me on that because I don't know that that's the case.
Okay.
But so I think it might be June.
Okay, so get back to me about your screening room, and then I'll keep track of what's going on with the series, and we'll follow up. And let's see what happens with Get Shorty. I would love to see that in 4K.
Well, get it done, Mike.